This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Oh, I don't plan on talking for this. I'm just here to watch you.
Okay, well, weird. I'm here for the same thing. Welcome, everyone. I'm Mark Moreland.
I'm Crystal Frazier.
And we are here to talk about nostalgia in gaming. For those people watching in the stream, I will be doing my best on my cell phone to check the chat, but will not be responding in chat, so... Yeah, we say stuff and we'll try and respond, but yeah.
It might be a lost cause unless Dan's here to navigate the chat for us.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see what happens. So I am Paizo's franchise manager. It's my job to ensure that both internally as well as especially our licensees are staying true to the brands, both Pathfinder and Starfinder. And so I do a lot of collaboration with our, miniatures producers and the folks at Owlcat who are doing the video game and everything, just on ensuring that their version of Pathfinder and Starfinder is consistent with ours, and both visually and stylistically and everything. So,
wait, did you just reveal that Owlcat's doing a Starfinder game? Because I didn't know.
No, that's not what I revealed at all. Like, for real. Don't even joke about that. You get me in trouble.
Somebody getting mail. Meanwhile,
Yes, exactly. InWorld is going to have a whole thread about this by the end of the hour.
Meanwhile, there's some cat at IGN busily banging away.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm Crystal Frazier. I'm a developer at Paizo Publishing. I work on the Adventure Path line primarily. Also work on player companions and campaign settings and. Sometimes fix flat tires because that's the kind of office we are.
And you work almost exclusively on Pathfinder.
Aside from I write for Starfinder as well.
Okay,
but all my development work is Pathfinder.
Yeah. So this panel started, I think last year was the first year we did it, and it was really about specifically how 80s cartoons made us better GMs. And we thought that this year, as much fun as that was, maybe we would open it up a little bit more and just talk about how nostalgia both has a history within the role-playing genre itself and how you as GMs or players can use your own nostalgia for things that you're a fan of to inspire either games you're running, characters you're playing, things like that.
I mean, we had enough just on, like, how 80s cartoons made us better GMs last year. I have no idea how we're going to fit anything into an hour now.
Yeah, okay. Well, if we start talking, that will help.
All you need to know is whole genre, nothing but nostalgia, it turns out.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look just at Pathfinder, our game really took off because people had nostalgia for a previous version of the game. And not just in terms of the rule set, but in terms of the types of adventures that we were producing. Mm-hmm. If you look at things like Rise of the Rune Lords, that really was a throwback to Against the Giants. And our campaign setting is full of examples of places where members of the staff or freelancers have said, you know what, I really like Expedition to Barrier Peaks. Let's make sure there's a place where I can play those adventures in our campaign setting.
If you want to know what sci-fi and fantasy James Jacobs, Wes Schneider, Eric Mona, and Jason Bullman were into as kids, all you have to do is read through our campaign setting.
Yeah, no, really. I mean, like, like, huh, I wonder if anyone at Paizo watched Thundar the Barbarian. Yep, you can see that in the realm of the Mammoth Lords or Numeria, or yeah, you know. So yeah, there's certainly that, and you know, it's
the land of the lost.
There is, yes, know, yes, there is.
Yeah,
there is.
I wonder who was it that read a bunch of Anne Rice novels in the 90s? And
yeah, yeah, totally not. Our late great Wes Schneider, who's not actually late, but is great, but is late of Paizo.
Shh, too soon.
Too soon. It has been a year. yeah, so, you know, that's certainly an approach that we take when we're creating the games, is to harken back to things that we liked. I mean, ultimately, our job is to make a game that fans like. But we can't get inside our fans' heads, nor do we really want to in a lot of cases. but we do know what we like. And so part of game design and brand management for something like Pathfinder or Starfinder is trying to keep your finger on the pulse of what it is that the fan community wants to play. You know, what are they going to find fun? And I think that to date, we've done a pretty good job of saying, well, I really enjoyed Jason the Wheeled Warriors, so yeah. I'm sure that the players will too. And so that's still something that we go to. But it is a fine line between homage or inspiration and just, you know, whole cloth filing off the serial numbers and calling it your own.
Which is fine for your home game, mind you.
Yes, and we'll be talking about that in the panel. But for published work, it is something that we always have to be wary of, both just for our own legal protection, but also because our professional reputation, we don't want to be the people who just, you know, make the copies of other people's games, which... You know, given Pathfinder's history is ironic, but, you know, it's what it is.
Yeah, but that's not on us.
That's not on us. No, no, no. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think we can get down to a little more nitty-gritty about, like, what elements of nostalgia make for a better play experience at the table. So, like, we can start off with, like, what about nostalgia for our favorite cartoons made us a better GM, and then roll into, like, how pulling from familiar tropes makes for a very easy shorthand language that everyone at the table
that's true. That's true. And there's a request from the chat that we repeat audience questions or comments because there is not a microphone on you guys, for better or worse. So
again, that's probably best.
Again,
that's
probably
best.
Okay, so yeah, why don't you talk on that, and I'll look here at the chat while you're going on that, just to see if we're missing anything.
So, if you weren't here last year for this panel, or like us, you were half asleep for this panel and don't remember it. a big crux of that earlier panel was how 80s storytelling kind of derived from earlier pulp storytelling, in that you have very iconic characters with very defined traits that you could sum up in one or two sentences, and then every story is a self-contained, very easy to communicate concept that wraps up in the case of cartoons, 30 minutes, but in the case of tabletop, 4 hours.
Right, and one thing too is that in addition to having these very caricatured characters, most of the stories, because they were children's cartoons, are wrapped up. They're basically just a morality lesson that you have each time. And one thing that RPGs can do very well is to put the players in positions where they have to really look at their own characters and make a tough decision. While it's fun to just go in and murder everything in the dungeon, some of the things that really stick in my mind, at least, from things that I have nostalgia for, are they are when a character was really tested and or learned a lesson, made a mistake, and had to, you know, make it right.
Like when Orko learned not to play in rockets.
Well, Orko learned a lot of lessons. yeah, so, you know, so it's so that's another aspect of it. And it's not just about cartoons. I mean, I think you can take movies, you could take books, you could take whatever. But the 80s specifically, as Crystal said, what really did that very well, I think. And maybe that's just our age. Yeah. That we think that maybe people who are a decade older than us think the 70s cartoons did it just as well. And, you know, kids today think that Barney did it. I don't know.
I think we can safely say that the 80s was the, like, the dawn of the mass media childhood.
No. Absolutely not.
Okay.
No, I mean, because I'm a generation older than you. I'm 54. And we were getting hit with it. I mean, I was there and 13, 14 years old when the science fiction renaissance happened in 1976. You know, all of a sudden you had Battlestar Galactica and Star Wars and the $6 Million Man and all of this stuff coming out. And prior to that, sci-fi was boring. It was like the last two sci-fi movies that came out of Hollywood were 2001 and Silent Running in like 1971, and they were all Herb Downer movies.
and don't forget Zardoz.
Oh, really.
Or maybe you should forget Zardoz.
Yeah, again.
Okay, so the audience
should forget
has,
Zardoz.
The audience has made you remember Zardoz. I'm sorry that they did that.
I guess.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's certainly the more media became part of people's everyday lives, the more that I think that people have that nostalgia. But I know that, you know, my parents have nostalgia for watching, you know, the Brady Bunch or whatever they watched, you know, Leave It to Beaver. You know, so
what?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And those don't necessarily lend themselves well to fantasy role playing, but I guess if you're playing, you know,
well, like we broke Valeros' nose right before the big dance.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, no, that's good.
Actually a lot of those sitcoms and in those 30-minute series or whatever, you did get those moral stories. You did get moral stories and things like Good Times and the Jeffersons and the Brady Bunch and things like that. That, you know, and one of the things that I took away from my childhood in the 70s was that for a lot of players at the table, you know, they say, well, my alignment is good and I proved that because I didn't do X or Y. It's like, no. Being good means you have to actively do good, not the absence of evil. Mm-hmm. You see what I mean? You actually have to give to the poor, not just, you know, not torture the prisoner.
Right. Yeah, so the comment from the audience is just that even older shows were morality tales, and that that you can still draw from those at the table as well. Did you want to continue with this or switch?
I think we can push into like broader nostalgia and why it's useful at the table.
Yeah, okay. Go for it.
This is your panel.
That's not my panel. We're both up here.
So one of the nice things about nostalgia and having that shared history with your group, even if you've never gamed together, is if I say, well, I didn't expect a Spanish Inquisition...
No one expects a Spanish Inquisition.
Yeah.
You've got this common language above and beyond English in our case, but that most gamers share and certain expectations that you could put out there. So, for example, if you put a bunch of goblin babies in the dungeon, it's accepted in the gaming community that, oh, this is a lazy GM morality test, and we have to argue now about whether or not to kill them, even though we're not supposed to kill them.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one thing that I've found, especially as a GM running things on the fly, because I don't have as much time to prep as I would like. I don't think any of us in the office do. Is that...
I mentioned I worked till 1 a.m. the day before today, right?
No, but that doesn't come as a surprise. That if you need to run something quickly, or you don't have the time to put together a whole lot of intricate NPCs and interweave their plots together, that taking something that everyone's familiar with, I mean, if you set the PCs up to go rescue someone from, you know, a hidden fortress of the enemy, and they have to, you know, you're setting up Star Wars right there, and everyone recognizes that plot without you needing to go through all the background of the, all right, so here's the setup. You can basically just say, hey guys, this adventure is basically Star Wars. Let's go. And there you go. And everyone knows what that is. And so that's one of the advantages of nostalgia as a shared experience. I mean, I could certainly run adventures based on something that happened to me in middle school. But no one else at my table knows what I'm talking about if I'm like, hey, remember that party that we went to that was super awkward? Yeah, let's do that so everyone prepare yourself for an awkward party.
Every night.
Every night, yeah. No, that was my middle school experience.
You got invited to parties?
They were very awkward, but yes. You know, but if I say, hey guys, I'd really like for this adventure to be like The Thing. So, you know, you're in an isolated science base and something weird is going on. Everyone basically knows what that backstory is and that buy-in. And so as long as everyone's cool with being in on the basic narrative, then you can really cut a lot of corners by doing that and give everyone an experience to relive something that they look back fondly on.
It gives people, it tells people where to suspend their disbelief without you having to invest a lot of time and energy in setting those boundaries yourself.
Do you find that telling people up front, like, hey, this is going to be like a thing, you're in an isolated science space, is better or worse than just running the isolated science space and letting the players halfway through say, oh my god, this is just like the thing?
The question was whether or not it's better to just run the isolated science base and let the players figure out that they're playing the thing, or to tell them up front. And I think it really depends on your players and the you know, the flow of the group.
Yeah, in general, I think it's better to talk up front and say, hey, this isn't a direct lift of the story, but it's the same theme and mood I'm going for. Just because players are smarter than you really want to admit as a GM, and they'll figure out that they're playing the thing pretty early on, and then they'll hang a lantern on it, and then your mood is dead.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it also depends how closely you're hewing to the source material. I mean, if you're doing an isolated science based, and it's not a shapeshifter, maybe it's some weird, like, mind control disease virus, that's different enough that you can probably not, you know, say, hey, everybody remember the thing? That's what we're playing. Because it's different and people can get the same thing. But once you start taking things more, you know, closely to the source material, once they know it, I think that then everything becomes an inside joke at the table. At least that's my experience, is then everything is someone quoting from the movie instead of playing with the theme. And so, unless that's what you're going for, I think that it's better to just be upfront with it, especially if it's a one-shot and you're playing with people who know that this is your play style. Yeah, so one of the things that that I've actually done for a few years now at PaizoCon is to run a reskinned Pathfinder, and this year a Starfinder game set in the Marvel universe. So that's one thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about, is how to reskin existing rule systems to better emulate the things that you're trying to connect people to. In the case of these Marvel games, I can pretty safely say, especially given the success of the Marvel movies, that if I say, hey, here's a character sheet for Captain America, that person is probably going to play that character very similarly to another person given the character.
Chopping firewood.
Yes. or, you know, pulling helicopters with their insanely large biceps. Yeah, that's my wife's reaction as well when we watch that scene, and I'm just like, Anyway.
Yeah, no one's that gay.
Yeah. So, you know, it's, and so this year I'm doing a Guardians of the Galaxy Starfinder game. And so one later today, one of the fun things about those is seeing how other people are able to take these rules that we all know and the pop culture reference that we all know and just really hit the ground running. And it's been great for me playing with strangers in a way that's much, that it's a very different experience than even running a Pathfinder Society game. Because there's two levels of connection at the game, both the rule set and the pop culture overlay. And so, yeah, it's always a fun design exercise for me to try and figure out how much I can reflavor the existing rules without it becoming completely foreign to the person sitting down there to run it. It's a fun challenge, and I definitely encourage anyone in the room or watching the chat to or watching the stream to think about what types of games you might want to run that are similar. And even if you have an ongoing campaign, there could be something really fun about taking a break maybe between Adventure Path volumes, or if you have a player who's going to be out of the country on vacation and you're not going to run your regular campaign, to do a one-shot where you say, we're going to use Starfinder rules and we're going to play G.I. Joe. Or we're going to play...
if you remember what G.I. Joe is.
Everyone knows it. Haven't they like kept it alive with those awesome movies where where the Ninth Doctor plays Destro? Isn't that a thing? Yeah, no? Okay. I must have dreamt that in a terrible fever dream. Yeah, we have a question from the audience.
What's your thoughts on using older content or trying for older content versus something that's trending currently?
The question was, what's our thought on drawing from older stuff or what's trending currently?
Honestly, it just depends on what gets you excited and what gets your group excited. The advantage of drawing from older material is there's a much bigger chance your players aren't familiar with it. So if I want to grab some plot ideas from Captain Simian and the Space Monkeys, odds are really good the rest of my group has not watched that show.
I don't know.
Unless Mark is in my group.
Unless me and half of the office are in your group, yes.
Only because I have made half the office sit down and watch Captain Simian and Space Monkeys.
That's true. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think that for example, I would love to run a Stranger Things horror campaign or supernatural campaign. There are rule systems that you could probably do it with that aren't Pathfinder or Starfinder. The Tales from the Loop is one from Modiphius that is basically running a Steven Spielberg movie from the 80s. That's an example of something that's current that is itself a throwback to older stuff. But I think you could just as easily run a Westworld game, either from the, you know, Yul Brynner movie or the current show, if you wanted to get a little bit more existential with it. You could run a, you know, Starfinder is a really good fit for an Expanse game. If that's a, you know... Without the magic. If you get rid of the magic, I think you can do a lot of it.
I think they have very different feels. You might want to look at the Expanse role-playing game coming out from Green Ronin at the end
of
the year.
Yes, Crystal has two jobs, and one of those is to promote her other company at PaizoCon.
I'm not dicking over. I'm giving our loving audience the best possible solution to their problems.
Yes.
Remember again with 1-900 shameless plug.
So, you know.
Because they're wonderful people, and they deserve the best.
Yes, yes. But in the absence of that game, because it's not out yet, right?
No, not until Gen Con.
Until Gen Con, you could run a Starfinder game. And again, you'd need to heavily modify it. I mean, my Guardians of the Galaxy game is using Starfinder rules, but there are a lot of things that I just had to say, that's not a thing in Marvel, so it's not here. Or that none of these characters use that. And so a lot of times when you're trying to emulate another IP with an existing rule set, you have to do a lot of tinkering. And sometimes you can do it as simply as saying, well, yes, Groot is a mystic, but he doesn't actually cast spells. Any of his spell effects are actually just his roots or his arms doing things. So hold person is just him holding a person.
So, like, he's a mystic who didn't use strength as a dump stat?
Oh, no. No, con is his primary stat. Yeah.
Too soon.
Yeah. In any case, yeah, I mean, I think that you can draw from both. And I think that the properties that at least I personally am the most connected to now are the new things that feel old. And I think that those are going to be your strongest bets, because someone who's familiar with the trope can get in on it, and someone who's familiar with the specific new thing that's the new hotness now. I mean, if you wanted to do a Rick and Morty game, you can do that, because Rick and Morty is itself playing on, you know, Back to the Future and similar things, where you have the mad scientist and the plucky young, you know, weird teenager who go on weird adventures in space and time.
You can also run a really good Ninja Turtles game using Pathfinder.
Yes. Yeah.
Which I'd have to dig out those notes, but
yeah, I mean, at this point, you know, yes, to toot our own horn, Pathfinder has been around for 10 years. We have a lot of rules for Pathfinder. The number of archetypes that we've got, the number of spells, Pathfinder is a huge wealth of existing rules that are mostly balanced that you can reflavor to be other things, you know. And so if you want to run a Ninja Turtles game, we have the advanced race guide that gives you tools to build a custom race that's going to be balanced with, you know, the human Casey Jones that's in your party. And we actually have the ninja class, but you could run each of the Ninja Turtles as a different class, honestly. I mean, you could run Leonardo as a
cavalier
almost, yeah.
And Raph is definitely barbarian.
Yeah, and Michelangelo's probably a bard.
Oh, yeah.
And Donatello is an alchemist. Without the bombs.
Yeah, he doesn't throw
without
bombs.
Without the bombs.
But...
maybe a vivisectionist if you change the flavor.
It's a whole new take on Donatello I'm not liking.
No, I just... He's a tinkerer. He likes to make gadgets and things, and we don't really have a tinkerer class. I mean, he would probably make a good mechanic, honestly, from Starfinder. Mixing the two games is harder than... I would like to admit that it is, because I've tried doing it, and it's very time intensive. In any case, any other questions or specific nostalgic things that people are interested in hearing our take on? Yeah.
How do you keep it from getting out of hand? Like, when you make a nostalgic reference, and like you were saying earlier, the player just rolls, and they just make jokes for a while, and then it kind of derails the game into everyone.
The question was, how do you rein in the players so that a simple nostalgic reference or thematic element doesn't derail the game and become, you know, an inside joke? It's hard. I mean, I think that's... How do you keep your players from just quoting Monty Python for an entire session? I mean, there are just certain things that you're not going to be able to do as a GM because gamers are gamers. But I think it comes to everyone being on the same page, you know. And if you name a character, you know, Professor Doom, and he's like a technomancer who wears a metal mask and lives in his medieval realm, then...
You're really hung up on Marvel right now.
I've spent a lot of brain space recently dealing with that. But if you do that and you don't sort of point out, like, this guy's obviously Dr. Doom, then your players can think that they're smarter than you by...
Never let your players think they're smarter than you.
Yeah, no, I mean, just in terms of maintaining control at the table, you know, and being the guide and the narrator of the story, if you don't point out the joke, when the players figure out the joke, they can try and throw it in your face and be like, oh, you're running Dr. Doom. And then at that point, you've lost control because they're going to keep doing that because it shifts the power dynamic. Not that it's a contentious power dynamic necessarily, but as the GM, you're the one who sets the stage for what's happening at the table. And once the players feel like they know what's under, you know, what card you have up your sleeve, then they're going to point it out all the time. So I think that's key, is to just be upfront about it, you know.
Yeah, a lot of it is, I mean, for some of it, you just kind of have to let them release it because, I mean, they've got that excitement, that energy. There's this certain glee people have when they see something they recognize, and that's got to go somewhere. So, I mean, a little bit of, like, deviation at the table is fine because the goal is for everybody to have a good time. But you need to be able to say, like, after a minute or two, like, okay, guys, let's get back on task.
Yeah. Yeah, and, you know, especially if it's something that's really cherished by a lot of people at the table, mm-hmm. they're going to have their own associations and their own, hopefully, good memories of this thing. You know, so if you're doing a He-Man thing, you know, and you specifically, you know, everyone builds a character that's just an action figure, really, and needs a story then to justify them, then, you know...
I feel so attacked right now.
That's your shtick, Crystal. If you read the little mini comic, that's your deal. Yeah, you know, like if you're running something and someone loves one aspect of, or like say the Ghostbusters, and one person really loves Janine. I mean, who doesn't? Uh-huh. Yeah, that they may want to focus on that aspect of.
I like Holtzman.
Okay. Yeah. Or that's another good example of something that is both old and new. It's if you're running a Ghostbusters game, there's no reason that you can't have Holtzman interacting with Egon. In fact, they would come up with some crazy stuff, I think, if you put them together.
If you're reading the current run of the IDW comics, that's exactly what's happening right now, and it's awesome.
Yeah. So, you know, that's an example of something where you can let your players run with stuff, and use that as a cue of where you should take the story. You know, if you have the whole thing built up where Winston is going to be the key NPC in your Ghostbusters game, and no one cares about Winston Aww. Because his character is underdeveloped and was added as an afterthought, it's true. Then, and no one's picking up on that, then maybe switch to a different, you know. Be ready to adjust on the fly so that the players get the experience that they want out of this nostalgic, you know, trip, as well as you as the GM.
Kevin? You didn't see the new one?
Oh, yes. Okay. I'm sorry. I thought you were referencing something I said, and I was like, I didn't say that word. I didn't say Kevin, did I? Am I accidentally saying words that I don't mean to be saying?
All the time.
Yes.
So changing track slightly, so what's your take on using nostalgia to set up an expectation with your players with your intention to subvert it and go in a completely different direction?
Yeah, so the question was, what's our take on setting up a nostalgic trope with the intention of subverting it to play with the player's expectations? And by Crystal's demonic laugh, I take it that she would never, ever do that, ever, not in a million years.
I'm really good at this. I'm really good at using nostalgic tropes and, like, character shorthand to make my PCs fall in love with certain NPCs to either motivate them to rescue them when kidnapped or just break their hearts when it turns out they're the villain.
Or whether they are destined to meet a terrible fate, as may be the case in an adventure path, but maybe not.
Spoilers?
I didn't say which one.
Okay, yeah. There might be an adventure path where you meet a very earnest individual who's looking forward to a long and productive life after a lot of struggle. And
yeah, and that's not meant to be. Yeah, no, I think that that's great. And that's another... No, I mean... That is great. No, I'm going to own it. That's awesome. Screw that guy.
Send all your complaints to mark.moreland@paizo.com.
Yeah, that's fine. I can set up email rules so that I don't have to... Yeah, I think that subverting people's expectations or playing with those is great. I mean, that's another great tool that nostalgia gives you, is that set of assumed assumptions. If you're running a...
Assumed assumptions?
Yes, you're assuming that your players are making assumptions. That, you know, if you're running a homebrew campaign, you don't have that same benefit. If you're just, if you're telling your admittedly awesome but vanilla fantasy story, the players, one of them could be expecting Tolkien, one of them could be expecting, you know,
Gallivant.
Yeah, one could be expecting a more like gritty Warhammer-esque, you know, thing. It really, there's so many different ways that that could go that it's harder to play on the player's expectations that way. But when you're starting with something that everyone can be like, oh yeah, okay, we're basically playing Labyrinth. I've seen that movie. You have 2 hours of shared experience and maybe some extra comics and things if people are really into it.
A board game, yes.
That you can play off of, but you pretty much know that if you have, you know, a fiery show up, that the players are all going to assume that those characters are going to act a certain way and have certain abilities. And so, yeah, that's a great way to get something that feels familiar to also feel new, is to set up a situation where players think that they know what's going to happen, but it turns out that, you know, this NPC that they took for one thing is actually something else. So that's great. There is a question from the chat. See, I said I would do it, and I'm doing it. where'd it go? Oh my gosh, they're just talking. Okay, so Mayor of Hook City. All right, that's quite the handle there.
All right.
Yeah. I'd love to hear the panel's thoughts on private eye settings. Does Starfinder or maybe even Pathfinder lend itself well to this form of narrative? Or do settings like this, which are traditionally a solo protagonist, not lend themselves well to a campaign with a party of four?
Honestly, I think private eye and investigation games work really well in our system, if you couple them with some pulp-style two-fisted action.
Yeah, I think that if there's not combat involved, I mean, the systems really are combat simulators in first and foremost, and a lot of the social or investigative subsystems are secondary to that. I mean, if you just look at the size of the combat chapter in either book, it is way larger than the skills section, for example.
I would, if you're going to run an investigation-focused game, I would absolutely recommend looking at Gumshoe, which is a detective-style game that is very easy to adapt to any other game that you like.
Yeah, you can almost take the investigative mechanics from Gumshoe and plug them into other game systems fairly easily. And that way you can still run your combat with Pathfinder or Starfinder, but when the players are interrogating witnesses, then you can use the Gumshoe system, which is designed to do that. In terms of the storytelling, I think one thing that works very well for that trope is the big twist at the end. You know, an investigative story where the reader or the viewer or the player knows who did it at the beginning, that's not much fun. You know, if you know who Kaiser Soze is from the beginning, the big reveal at the end is not as powerful. So I think that the key there is to obfuscate that, but leave it open enough. I mean, it can be really tough to balance that that chainsaw, you know, because it's
what kind of role-playing games are you running?
You know, the kind where you have to balance a chainsaw.
So it's graded on a pass-fail system.
Yes, yes, exactly. Save, or, I mean, save or suck.
Yes.
you know, the... yeah, one thing I did, I wrote an investigative scenario. It was one of the first Pathfinder Society scenarios I wrote, actually, even before I was working at Paizo, was Murder on the Throaty Mermaid. Which is where you are on a, you as the PCs are on a ship, and you're supposed to be escorting a diplomat on a, this long sea voyage. And in order to keep the diplomat safe, you have booked passage on this pirate ship where every single person there is probably a murderer. Spoiler,
safe.
The diplomat gets murdered, and you have to figure out who did it before you arrive, so that the where you're escorting him, you can be like, yeah, sorry, the dude is dead, but that person did it, to hopefully save some face or you, with these people that you're meeting. So what I did was I read a whole bunch of Agatha Christie. Like, I just they're one of the benefits of that genre is that those books are 200 pages maybe. They're often mm-hmm. short. They're quick reads, and they're very formulaic, while still having a twist at the end. And so if you want to run that investigative gumshoe-style thing, read a bunch of Sherlock Holmes, you know, and take elements that work from those. If you know your players have not read, especially the later, less famous Sherlock Holmes, just take one of those, you know, then you don't have to come up with the twist. Conan Doyle already did it for you. You don't have to. It's like, that's done. And then you can just worry about telling your story. So that's my advice on that.
I'd also say, like, the concern that detective stories tend to be very singular versus, like, a group of four. I think the difference is more that detective stories just tend to be told from a first-person narrative, because...
Yeah.
Almost always in the detective story, there's the love interest who helps, and there's one or two strong guys who help.
Or there's the guy on the inside, the cop who's on the inside who can give the detective access to, you know, case files or evidence or whatever.
And if you think of all of those as your party instead of one main character and, like, contacts.
Yeah, I mean, you could also run it as, like, a NCIS... or, you know,
yes,
something similar to that, where you're the team that's investigating the, you know, you're the crime scene investigators, and you're not necessarily profiling people. That's not your job. Your job is to find all the evidence and piece together what happened here. Then that's another way to do it. Or you could run it like, you know, like everyone gets in the mystery machine, and your Scooby's gang, which is they're solving mysteries, and, you know, each character has their own strength and weakness. Most of the case, they have weaknesses, but yeah. So that's another way to handle that with a party.
Yeah, check out Miss Fisher's Murder Mysteries if you want to see, like, a team of crime solvers.
Right.
Any other questions from the chat? Any other questions here in person? We've kind of...
Yeah, we've got maybe 5 more minutes here before we have to wrap up to make room for the next... yes?
I think on that Marvel
adventure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. How you spent on that? Tell me about that process. The question was about my process when doing my Marvel reskins. It's tough. I mean, I... 2 years ago, I did an Invasion of Latveria, where the players were, you know, based just superheroes that were going into Latveria. And for that, because it's medieval themed, I was able to just run most of the enemies straight out of the bestiary. So a lot of it is reflavoring, especially for the GM facing stuff that I do. They were, you know, the Doombots were just clockwork soldiers that I gave a ranged weapon. You know, they had, like, a laser gun. that made that level of prep super easy, and I would say I probably spent maybe an hour, hour and a half going through and looking at what minis I had and saying, yeah, he could. There could be a giant spider there, and maybe it ends up being a robot. Who knows? But I could just take the spider and run the spider stat block, and that was super fast. The player characters, I probably spent about that same amount of time on each one. So for a six-player game, it's, you know, that's six times an hour and a half, 9 hours. Probably a little bit more because I lay them out with art and I try and make them look nice for the players. And that's really a much more nuanced process because I'm basically saying, okay, I'm running Wolverine. What abilities does Wolverine have?
He's the best there is at what he does.
He is the best he is at what, and that's why he's two levels above everybody else. he has the advanced simple template. Not really, no. You know, so I basically had to figure out what abilities do I want this character to have, and then just go through, you know, my extensive library of Pathfinder materials to figure out how to emulate that, what things to take from this class and mix with that, and where to invent something new. So in the case of Wolverine, he's a slayer who's got fast healing and built-in claw attack that's adamant. You know, like, we have rules for adamantium, basically.
We have rules for adamantine.
We have rules for adamantine, but in this setting it was, you know. And so when I was doing Captain America's shield, for example, I could invent vibranium, or I could just say, you know what, vibranium is mithril, and just use those rules and say that in this game, anything that's mithril is now made of vibranium, and anything that's made of uru is cold iron. And that's a simple reskin of the existing rules so that I can sit down and at the table and say, hey guys, I'm going to call cold iron uru, and we're going to call adamantine adamantium, and we're going to call mithril vibranium. And everyone at the table can then play the game that they already know and just use the different words. Guardians of the Galaxy game that I'm running now, I would say took me a little bit less time because Starfinder is newer, and so there's less rules that I could go down the rabbit hole trying to find the exact right fit. You know, with Pathfinder, there's 10 years worth of material for me to go through. So if I'm like, I'm sure there's a feat that'll let me make Wolverine just right, there probably is, but I could spend way more time than I did trying to find it. So with Starfinder, there's less material out there for it, so I could more easily say, I've looked through everything, and there's not this thing I'm looking for, so I need to make a new thing. So it's really I would say that the key to the process is figuring out what you want the character to do, and then backwards engineering it and reflavoring as much as you can to save yourself time and to give the player a touchstone that they're familiar with. But don't be afraid to create your own stuff. So if you're running a Ghostbusters game, you can probably do a lot of that stuff with the investigator or the alchemist or, you know, some of the mechanic. But at the end of the day, you have to design a proton pack. We don't have rules for that, as far as I know. Maybe we do. Maybe Occult Adventures has a fantasy proton pack. I don't know.
I actually made a Ghostbusters game a couple of years ago for a con game, and yeah, I basically ended up doing a system where it applies a cumulative bonus to CMB checks, and you can use it for CMB checks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
From range against ghosts.
Yeah. Yeah. Against ethereal ghosts.
Yeah, yeah.
So, also blows up chandeliers.
Yeah. Did that answer your question? Yeah. I plan on, and I've said this for 3 years now, sharing those character sheets and some of my notes. I mean, my Thanos stats, I probably am not going to share just because that's too much of a spoiler. But the the player characters I meant to put up on social media for a long time and just haven't gotten around to it. So watch my Twitter and I'll say where to find them when I put them up.
Where's your Twitter, Mark?
At Yoda Ate My Head with the number 8. What's your Twitter?
Oh, my Twitter is at Amazon Cheek, spelled C-H-I-Q-U-E.
And we've got time for maybe one more short question. If I can keep myself from rambling for 5 minutes. Yes.
Earlier you mentioned watching the Watch of the Wheeled Warriors.
Yeah. Yes, Jason the Wheeled Warriors was awesome.
Do you remember Visionaries?
Yeah, the Knights of the Magical Light? Yeah. Who doesn't?
Yeah, where they gave the power of invulnerability, which I thought was an interesting trope, because normally it's the strong, you know, strong warrior type, and it's the coward thing.
Yeah, actually, there's a great podcast out there called Gameable Saturday Morning that specifically watches old Saturday morning TV shows and tells you how to turn them into role-playing games. And they just 2 months ago did Visionaries specifically. So, yeah, if you're interested in this topic and want to go into more detail than we have been able to do in an hour covering a very broad subject, I would highly recommend them. I will be on next month.
No.
What's it called again?
Gameable Saturday Morning. It's by the same guy who does the Mega Dumb Cast.
I don't know why I haven't been on the Mega Dumb Cast before.
Because it's about Palladium games.
Oh, and not just about Mega Dumb things?
No.
Okay.
There's way too much to cover in that. Too broad a subject.
Yes.
Kind of like nostalgia in gaming.
It's true. It's true. Well, thank you all for coming. If you have further questions, come up to us later at the show, or if you are not at the show, start a message board thread. I think you should be able to start one at all the events. Just go on paizo.com and you can either post under this event in the PaizoCon section, or just start a new thread and we'll try and find it. And
or ask us on Twitter.
Yeah. So
where we actually hang out.
Yes. So again, thank you, and that wraps it up.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KDCon team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. To find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts, visit nodirectionpodcast.com.